A conversation with the organization whisperer, David Childs, PhD. It's episode 39, season 2020, Grow Great, the podcast. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio. You are listening to Grow Great, the podcast. The website is growgreat.com. Let's get to this. Serendipity happened. I was traveling, part business, part pleasure. I'm a few states away from home. Home is Texas, Dallas-Fort Worth. I walked into the place to get some information, and I come face-to-face with a gentleman who had spent decades in Texas. In fact, he lived here in DFW for many, many years, the place that I had driven from for this trip. And he introduced himself, David Childs. And as we chatted, it was apparent that we had a number of things in common. He was mostly, but not altogether, retired. A few years earlier, he and his wife had left the DFW area, and they'd come here to this place, the place of their encore home. It was closer to her family in St. Louis and a beautiful place. Turns out David had extensive experience in building high-performing cultures inside teams and organizations. And on learning about my work, he said, wait here a second. I got a book I'd like to give you. And he goes out to the parking lot to his vehicle, and I walk outside standing by mine. We'd been wearing masks. We're socially distanced and all that. Always on the prowl for a good book. You know, I'm happily going to wait if somebody offers to give me a book. And David approaches me and he hands me this oversized paperback book entitled The Organization Whisperer. And I look on the cover and I see the author, David Childs, PhD. And I'm like, look at you, Mr. Big Shot Smarty Pants. I didn't know it was your book. We talked for a little bit about the book and what had prompted him to write this book, and then I asked him to autograph it for me, which he graciously did, and I thanked him and told him, I want to keep in touch. Let's keep in touch. And we did keep in touch. And so just recently, David was gracious enough to meet me, and we got socially distanced and in a quiet corner in his room and his home, and he held a microphone. I held a microphone, and we had a conversation, and you're about to hear that conversation. I started to divide this up into two parts because this is about a 60-minute conversation, but then it dawned on me, you know, this is a podcast, and you've got these, you got something called a stop button, you know, and your podcast app, it will likely remember where you left off, so I'm just going to give you the whole thing. I couldn't find a really good spot to kind of make a break at the 30-minute mark. So here's the whole shebang. And I think you're going to get value out of this. I talked in the last episode about high performance, and it has been my fixation all of my career. And it's one thing that David and I have greatly in common. And so I hope you find value in this episode. So enjoy the conversation with the organization whisperer. He is Dr. David Childs, PhD.
As Charles Dickens said, I am born. A lot of who all of us are starts with our upbringing. And my upbringing included having a commitment to just doing a good job. And so I had that ingrained in me by my family to just try to be the best that you can be.
And you grew up where?
In North Louisiana. My parents lived in Shreveport, and I grew up in Shreveport. But both of my sets of grandparents lived about 50 miles out of Shreveport, out in the country. And each of my grandparents had farms. And in fact, I still own one of those farms, and I grow timber on it. So I still own that old family spread. I spent a lot of time at the farm on weekends, and in the summers, going to my grandparents' farms was my summer camps. And so I learned from my grandparents traditional values, if you will, and I also learned, the farm life and working hard and being responsible and accountable, because if you're not responsible and accountable, you're going to pay the price for it. You're going to, fall down, or you're going to hurt yourself, or the horse is going to kick you or something. And, oftentimes I think to this day that a lot of the issues that our country has are because a lot of our population has lost its contact with nature and being in touch with the country, where, Mother Nature just automatically imposes some accountability and some responsibility. And at any rate, that's another story. But I think we could, as a country, I think we could use a little more country in some of us. At any rate, with that as my background, I finished college, and I got asked to come work in an organization. And a lot of what we're going to talk about here, I will just speak of organizations, because over time, I've worked in and I have consulted in the government sector, in private business sector, in the nonprofit sector, and a lot of what I talk about is universal. A lot of what I say, a lot of what I do, a lot of what I recommend, a lot of what I advise, over the years, I have adapted it so that it is conducive to any organization. Now, different organizations do have different internal cultures. There are aspects of working in government that are different than being in the military. And there are aspects of military culture that are different than the private sector. And the nonprofit has its own culture. So each of those organizations does have some unique aspects to it. But underpinning all of that, there are some deeper core values and truths that can permeate across all types of organizational cultures. And that's where I attempt to address my comments, so that the things that I say or recommend can actually be adopted and can be valuable to any type of organization, public, private, nonprofit, whatever. I started my career, and the very first day that I started working in this organization, and this was back in the very early 80s, when, believe it or not, back in those days, in some places, computers were still a newfangled thing, and computers didn't even exist very much in some places. And I was working in one of them. So I was working in this organization where there were still a lot of ladies typing up things on typewriters. And it's my first day. I'm just kind of trying to learn my way around. And I walk up behind this lady, and I watch her, and she puts a form in this typewriter, and down the left margin there are 13 blanks, and she typed the same name, Joe Jones, whatever, 13 times, and she took that one out, and she put in another piece of paper, and she typed the same name, Bill Johnson, 13 times. And I watched her do this 3 or 4 times, and so finally I said, "Ma'am," I said, "do you always type exactly the same name all 13 times, or does it vary occasionally?" And she stops, and she looks like a deer in the headlights, like she's never even thought about it. And finally she goes, "No, I type in the same name all 13 times." So I said to her, I said, well, ma'am, could I have a couple of your blank sheets? And she said, sure. So I went back to my desk. I sat down at my typewriter. And in the 12 blanks on the sheet after the first one, I just typed in the above mentioned. And then I went and made about 500 copies of that sheet. And I took it back to her. And we reduced her workload by about 90%. And it was just that experience where I had this epiphany. I had this just moment. And I said, this is what I want to do. I want to spend my life learning and sharing ways that things can just be done better. And, of course, the longer I went through my career, it got a lot more sophisticated than just looking for blanks that could be eliminated on a form. I got certified in Baldrige, and I got certified in Lean, and I got my PhD in management, and particularly began studying the practices. I developed a particular interest in what do excellent organizations do differently. What separates excellent organizations from mediocre ones? What is different in just their day-to-day operational behavior? And I've really invested a lot of energy in that, and I talk a lot about that. I talk a lot about the specific day-to-day actions and behaviors that excellent organizations do differently than mediocre ones, and there are several of them. And in fact, if you would like, I will just segue on in,
please.
And a story that I'm telling right now, because I've recently encountered some data that is very, very appropriate to the discussion of excellent organizations versus mediocre ones. And people may say, well, what's the difference? How do you know? How can you tell? How can you define the difference between mediocrity and excellence? Or they may just be saying, why do I care? You know, what could doing something differently do for me? How would it benefit my organization? A few years ago, Gallup, the polling people, Gallup did an international study of organizations, and they studied about 2,000 organizations worldwide, asked them several pages of questions, and based upon the questions that they asked, they sort of identified organizations that by their definition had created a high-performing culture of excellence within that organization versus typical organizations. The first thing they found was that they were able to identify about 5% of all organizations have a significant degree of the elements of a high-performing culture that helps them do things that just help them perform better, be more efficient, be more effective at achieving their outcomes, reducing their errors, doing their processes more rapidly, having a more satisfied staff with more longevity, having more satisfied customers, those types of criteria. About 95% of organizations fall into the category of your typical everyday organization. They found also that the 5% of organizations that they identified as actually living a high-performing culture on a day-to-day basis, those organizations were 22.5% more productive. That's like production per staff person. How many phone calls get answered? How many forms get filled out? They have a 19% higher staff stability, 19% less turnover. So they have staff with longevity, knowledge, experience, staff that wants to be there versus staff that's constantly leaving, and they're constantly having to invest energy in recruiting, hiring, training. They found that high-performing organizations, even after they initially implement the culture, and it was found that when you first implement a high-performing culture in what has been a traditional organization, in the first couple of years that you implement that culture, you're going to find a lot of low-hanging fruit. You're going to find a lot of instances where the lady is typing the same name 13 times. And the high-performing culture is going to find that, and they're going to recreate the form so she only types it in once. You multiply that by 1,000 things that are going on in typical organizations, and over the first couple of years that a high-performing culture is implemented, they will improve their overall performance, which is measurable, which is another element of high-performing cultures, is they measure everything. You're going to improve your operations generally between 30 and 40%. So you're going to improve your efficiency. You're going to improve your bang for buck. You're going to improve the outcome based upon the resources that you're spending to invest in it by 30 to 40%. Then after the first couple of years and you've gathered all that low-hanging fruit and eliminated all of that waste, even after that, going on into perpetuity, the Gallup poll found that high-performing organizations continue to improve annually by an average of about 5% because they have created a culture of desiring to constantly get better. Not only the CEO, but the whole organization. I've got a story that I tell about an organization where the janitor was constantly sending directly to the CEO his recommendations about how to do things better with the trash and cleanup and the cigarette ashtrays and just all kinds of things, where the janitor is constantly actually interested in improving the area that the janitor deals with and was interacting directly with the CEO of the organization to discuss that. That's the high-performing culture, and that 5% of ongoing, constant, motivated desire to improve goes on constantly, even after the initial 30 to 40% improvement. So those are the benefits that were identified in an international study. Now, to break it down to a one organization specific, and this is why I've gotten back into this recently, because as I said, I've recently seen some fascinating data. I used to tell the story, and this recent data now supplements it. I used to tell the story about, well, why should someone be interested in adopting a high-performing culture in their organization? And the answer that I would sometimes give was that 6 weeks after 9/11, and of course when 9/11 happened, the airline industry was just shut down by the government. Government said no planes in the air. 6 weeks later, at the end of October, the airlines put out their monthly financial report, and it was found 6 weeks after 9/11 and all planes had been grounded, that one airline, which happened to be Southwest Airlines, one airline had 90% of the net worth and the total value of the entire airline industry. In the 6 weeks of that crisis, in the 6 weeks that the wolf came calling, one airline had built a high-performing culture of bricks, and all of the other airlines had been playing the quarterly house of straw shell game. And when the wolf came calling, it was very easy to blow down all of their smoke and mirror and straw houses. And Southwest Airlines had been built on bricks and core and foundation that withstood that. Now, that was in 2001. 18 years later, I have just recently read new data about the impact of COVID. The wolf came back 18 years later. The impact of COVID on the airline industry. And I've read two different articles, one of them talking about how since COVID came, American Airlines has cut 40% of staff. Southwest Airlines has cut no one. And every other airline is dropping airports that they serve. They're dropping service airports. Southwest Airlines is in the process of adding 10 additional airports that they're going to start serving. So 18 years after 9/11 and Southwest ended up with 90% of the net worth of the airline industry, 18 years later, everybody else was still building quarterly houses of smoke and mirrors and straw. Southwest, for this last 18 years, has retained its loyalty and its commitment to having a day-to-day high-performing culture. And in the midst of COVID, while all other airlines are shrinking, Southwest is retaining all of their staff and is actually expanding their service airports. So those are the reasons why implementing a high-performance culture can be beneficial to the strength of your organization, to the well-being of your staff, to the satisfaction of your customers, and also to your pocketbook. All of the above.
What's your opinion about from bottom up grassroots movements versus the top? I mean, these are stories that are fascinating. But, you know, it with Southwest, it starts with a guy like Herb Kelleher, you know, one of the founders, and just his fanatical pursuit of customer happiness as well as employee happiness. And you and I both know that there are organizations that sentiment, that philosophy doesn't necessarily exist at the top. Are the companies that are run by leaders that don't see this, are they doomed? I mean, if you're a part of a company like that, are you just stuck, or is there anything that you can do at some level in the organization, even with a small team, to maybe get some groundswell happening?
Yes, there is, and I have seen it repeatedly and successfully, and I have seen it in two different ways. The first way that I've seen it is that in my own personal career, I have moved around some. I actually, as it got kind of more towards the end of my career, I was actually sort of identified as a fix-it guy. And my last two or three jobs that I had, I was actually recruited to come to an organization that was in free fall and collapse. In a couple of instances, the organization was even on the front page of the paper for corruption and those kinds of things. And I got asked to come in and fix it, so to speak. And I found repeatedly in my personal career that I would come into an organization that was on the front page of the paper, that was an embarrassment, that was in total collapse. And I would start personally modeling quality, and that's where the CEO at the top sometimes has an impact. But the point that I'm getting to is that in every instance where I would enter an organization and I would make it clear that I was open to doing things in a quality way, there were always significant members of the staff, the line employees, the janitor, a few of the managers, that were eager and excited about wanting to build a quality organization. I found repeatedly in every organization that I joined, staff that had an internal desire to enjoy going to work, to enjoy doing what they were doing, and to have pride in their organization, to have pride in the company that they worked for. They didn't want to come to work and spend their whole day having customers sending angry emails and, why didn't I get this? And, oh, I got this and it's got a mistake in it and blah, 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 blah. People don't want to spend their life like that. People want to spend their life being proud of what they do and what they are a part of and who they are. And I found that constantly and repeatedly. I will say that I did find a tendency in the organizations that I joined that there was a lot more desire to improve among the line staff than among the managers that I inherited. I found that the managers were more motivated to protect their little fiefdom.
Sure.
Their number one, their control, and number two, their job and their salary and their status. They had reached a point where they had gotten some sense of accomplishment in life. Oh, I made it to be a manager, and I've got a little bit more of an income, and I have a little bit more bells and whistles, and now my motivation is more to protect my bells and whistles than it is to improve on a daily basis. And so whenever I would initially enter an organization, I would find initial buy-in more from the line staff wanting to improve their quality of life. That lady that had to type in the same name 13 times, she loved only having to do it once instead of 13
sure.
times. So you start off there, and that's where you get the buy-in. It's also where you get the ideas. Those are the people actually doing it. The janitor knows more about the bathroom than the CEO does. If you want to know how to improve the bathroom, ask the janitor. So you get more initial buy-in there. And then what I have found is that once you are able to identify low-hanging fruit and to get some wins at the lower level, if that lady filling in the 13 blanks all of a sudden improves her productivity by 90%, that gets her manager's attention and that gets the CEO's attention. If another lady reduces by 75% her errors because you worked with her, she could tell you how she could reduce her errors. And so if you work with her to do that and she reduces her errors by 75%, her manager will pick up on that and the CEO will pick up on that. So a lot of what I have found is that if you start at the line level, at the worker bee level, and you work with the worker bees to actually create change and improvements there, then once you are able to document the improvements, then that percolates up to the higher levels. I also found exactly the same thing, not only in the organizations that I personally took over and managed, but I also taught some MBA classes. And a lot of my MBA classes were line employees. They were line employees who were attempting to get their MBA and progress up the chain. And so I would teach them some of the specific behaviors and actions of the high-performing cultures. And I would assign them to the ability that they had to do so to go into their real workplace and for them to try to think of some way to actually implement some of the concepts I was teaching in the class. And I repeatedly had students come back to me and say that because of things that they had implemented just personally at their own desk, because that's all they had the power over, or maybe they got three of their coworkers to do the same thing, whatever power they had at their disposal to permeate out from where they were, I got constant feedback of their bosses and the bosses above them picking up on it, seeing it, and saying, "What are you doing?" in a constructive way, because they were then seeing the results. So I agree with you that, yes, sometimes it is hard to get the top of the pyramid to change because the top of the pyramid has become comfortable with what the pyramid has already done for them. And they don't think about how much more it could do for them. Imagine if you're a CEO of a company and you're getting a stock option in that company, and if you implemented a high-performing culture, your organization was going to increase its value by an additional 5% every year. You're going to get an increased stock option of that extra 5% every year. But as you're sitting here right now, you can't see that and you can't understand that. You're just happy with the stock option you're already getting. So it takes somebody else in the organization that is in a position where they still feel motivated for those people to get the ball rolling and for those people to show the results that permeate up the pyramid.
I like it because I'm fixated these days, David, on kind of this notion of grow where you're planted. It seems to me that so many people are waiting for permission and they take the attitude, well, if only this person or if only that would happen, as opposed to, well, what can you control right now where you're at?
I saw that both in the organizations that I led and I would go to the line staff and I would say to the line staff, I would say, you tell me, how to fix this. And initially, people that I had just inherited, they would say, oh, we can't do that. We would not pretend to do that. And I had to tell them, yeah, go ahead and do it. When I was teaching the MBA classes, I would tell my students, you're going to go back into your daily organization and you're going to implement this. And I got a lot of kickback. I got a lot of, no, I can't do that. No, they won't let me. And I would say, tell them it's a class assignment. Tell them you're just doing it as a class assignment, as an experiment. So, there is something about saying that something has to do with education that makes it not as much of a threat.
Right.
I think it says something about our society that we don't look at education as a threat for some reason. So, if you're doing this for class, then that's meaningless and that's worthless and that's not a threat to me. And then the next thing they know, they go into the boss and they say, look, we've increased this by 50%. And the boss goes, wow, well, how did you do that? And they said, it started with our class at school. Another thing I would have people do is I would tell them, I'm sure you're familiar with it, I would tell them to read John Maxwell's 360 Leadership. And, that, 360 Leadership is all about, okay, how can you lead from where you are?
Right.
How can you lead as the janitor?
Yeah.
The janitor can be a leader. So yes, everybody can be. It just starts with a lot of them have the want to. Doesn't start with want to. A lot of them already have the want to. It's going from the want to giving them just the courage to just do it.
Right.
The courage to just do it.
You spoke about, an organization that's on the front page and scandalous and, in bad shape. What's your opinion about those companies, though? And I suspect that there's a greater number of these kinds of companies where they're really smitten with just looking at their work and going, it's good enough. It's not great, but it's good enough. And maybe they've got this brain lock and thinking that, to get it substantially better, just too much work.
Um,
There's a reason that average is average, right? I mean,
yeah,
because it's typical.
A lot of times I have found that they don't know any better. A lot of times I have found that they don't know they're bad. All they know is who they are. It's like a sports analogy. It's like if two sports teams play a game and they don't keep score. So there is no score.
Right.
They play the game, it stays 0-0, and if you're watching it on TV, you can see one team is just kicking the other team off of the field. But there's no score. And at the end of the game, the team that if they'd been keeping score, it would have been 56-0. That team walks off the field and they went, "Hey, we did pretty good. We only had one fumble. We didn't have any injuries. We can be proud of ourselves." And I see a lot of that.
The fact that they're not, that the average company isn't measuring things that they ought to measure?
Yes.
Yeah, because you said high performing cultures, they do measure.
Right. And the organizations that are lousy, they don't know they're lousy. Even a couple of the organizations that I took over that had been on the front page of the paper. I mean, the newspaper is saying,
right,
you stink. And when I took them over, and I took over the same staff, all that had happened was they'd fired the boss and replaced me as the new boss, and I inherited the same staff. And in fact, one of the organizations that I took over, the very first meeting that I called was a meeting of my department heads. And it was just a meet and greet. It was a chance for me to meet them. And that first meeting, and this organization had been on the front page of the paper, my first day on the job, I called a meeting of the managers in the conference room. We're sitting around the conference room, and in that meeting, the managers started pointing and cussing at each other across the conference table. That was my welcome to them. That's what I inherited. A year and a half later, I'm sitting at my desk one day. One of the staff line employees sticks her head in the door. Notice that by this time, the line employees felt they could go straight to the CEO. That had been implanted. This line employee sticks her head in my door, and she says, "Dr. Childs, we were just at lunch, and we were talking about how to improve this process, and we have thought of a way to do this process more efficiently." And I said, "So what's the idea?" And she said, "Well, we could tweak this, and we could do that, and we could do this." And I said, "Have you thought of X, Y, and Z?" And she said, "Yes, X, Y, and Z would be handled this way." And I said, "Go do it." She heads back down the hall. I turned around. I picked up the phone. I call my wife, and I said to my wife, "We're done with this job." The high-performing culture has permeated down to the line staff and to the break room. The line staff is sitting at lunch in the break room improving the organization. And that happened in a year and a half after being on the front page of the paper and after the inherited management team had a cussing fight with each other. That was in a year and a half. Let me come back to measuring. My entire career, every time I hear somebody say, "I need more staff, I need more resources," I've heard that, you know, I'm sick of hearing it. I've heard that for 40 years. "I need more staff, I need more resources." I've created three questions over the years. Question number one, how long does it take you to perform your most common repetitive task in your organization, what is your most common repetitive task that your organization does, and what is the average length of time it takes to do it? I have about 5 to 7% of people that I've ever asked that question that can answer it.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's even that high.
But they need more staff and resources.
Right.
Yet, they have some of them don't even know. Some of them don't even know what their most common task is.
Right.
Some of them don't even know that. But then almost nobody knows how long it takes to do it. Is it 30 seconds? Is it 7 minutes? Almost none of them know how long it or should take. See, there's how long does it take, and then there's how long should it take, and they certainly don't know that. You know, there's the legendary Southwest Airlines story that when Herb Kelleher was still running Southwest. And by the way, notice that Herb Kelleher has now been gone for 15 to 20 years, mm-hmm. but the culture is still there. Even with new leadership and management, the culture survives. Any rate, when Kelleher was still there, there's this legendary meeting, and it's still taught in business management schools. They were in a meeting one day, and they were talking about, well, how can we speed up our turnaround time on the ground? We come in for a landing, we pull up, the customers get off, the staff cleans up the plane, the next customers get on, and we pull back away. From the time of pulling up to the
gate,
from the time of pulling up to the gate until it pulls back away, clock that. How long is that? And Herb says, if we can improve that, and if we can improve that enough with each flight, we could maybe even have time to add one additional flight a day or whatever. So this was his original challenge. So they're sitting around there talking about, well, we could do this, well, we could do that, well, we could do this. And they started getting into, well, you know, our average turnaround time is 18 minutes and Americans is 22 and United's is 24. Well, first of all, they already knew that. They already mm-hmm. knew that information, which is what this question is. They already knew that, but they're saying, "Oh, well, we're already good. We're already the best. We're at 18 minutes, and the next best is at 22." And Herb Kelleher is sitting at the head of the table, and he listens to this, and he goes, "How come NASCAR can turn a car around in 32 seconds?" That's what high-performing organizations do. That's the conversation that high-performing organizations have that typical organizations are clueless about. Second question, who are the best, most efficient, and most effective organizations in your profession? So if you're a fast food hamburger place, if you're McDonald's or Burger King or whatever, do you know how long it takes you to make a Big Mac versus how long it takes a Whopper to make a Whopper? Do you know what is your cost? What is your operating cost of a Big Mac versus the operating cost of a Whopper? Now, in those businesses, they may actually know that because they are extremely right. competitive down to the half a penny. So, and that's just what popped in my head as an right. example. But whatever your profession is, for example, I work some of my life in government, particularly in governments. Governments do very, very little comparative measuring. For example, almost all governments, if you were to say, how much does it cost you in your street department to fill a pothole? What is the cost per pothole? They have no idea. If you were to ask them, which city in your state fills potholes the most efficiently? Which city in your state has the lowest cost per pothole? Which city in your state, if a phone call comes in saying, there's a pothole on our street, how long does it take you to get out there and fill it and respond to it? Nobody knows that. If you're a court system, if you're the court system of a county and somebody asks how many cases get handled in a year by a court compared to other counties around the state. How does your county court rank in terms of cases handled in the rankings of the counties in the state? Nobody knows that.
Is there a reason?
Yeah, because they just don't do it. They just
don't care.
I don't know that they don't care. Certainly it's just never occurred to them.
They don't think to do it.
They don't even think to do it. Now, in some cases, particularly in government, I talked a little while ago about how the different types of organizations, they have different aspects to their culture. And one of the differences in government culture from the private sector, the private sector is really motivated to make money. And so they have a motivation to improve. They still don't do it, but at least in their culture, they have a core motivation to want to improve, because ultimately they'll make more money from doing so if you will show them how to do it. Whereas in government, there's really not as much motivation. If you really ask people in government what are they motivated by, they will tend to tell you, we are motivated to stay out of trouble. We are motivated to not get in trouble with the public. We are motivated to not end up on the front page of the paper. Our motivation is to hunker down, be an ostrich, stick our head in the sand, and hope everything will go away. Well,
and yet they're living in a world of finite resources as opposed to a business that can say, okay, we can lower our cost, or we can elevate ourselves.
Yeah, but in their mind, they are of the belief, well, we can just constantly raise taxes. There is this mindset that there's a bottomless money pit. And by the way, as a society during COVID, we have now crossed as a nationwide, our federal government has now crossed our national debt being over 100% of GDP. National debt being over 100% of GDP is a financial, economically proven benchmark for disaster. You're talking about Greece. You're mm-hmm. talking about Spain. Those places got over 100%. Well, we now are. And you will one day have to pay the piper. The question is, you keep seeing that light coming through the tunnel. And generally, you don't pay that light too much attention until it's way too close to do anything about it. And we are there as a society in government financing. Our government financing is mathematically in some serious trouble. The day will come when governments are going to have to be mindful of that. But it's not there yet. My third and last question that I sometimes ask people that say, I need more resources, I ask, who are your five most productive staff? Right now, name me your five employees that are your all-stars.
How many know that answer?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of a different answer. Generally, a lot of people could name five employees. And of course, those five employees would be ones that they personally were. If you're in a 100 employee organization, and if you're a typical CEO who spends most of your life just in your office and you never venture out to interact with staff, you never manage by walking around MBWA,
right.
You never manage by walking. So all you know about your organization is the people that come into your office. Maybe there's a line employee somewhere that's like the daughter of a cousin or something. You got a family hire down there somewhere that you happen to know about. Those are the five people that you name. You see all of these polls where they ask Americans who were the five greatest presidents. And it's always Washington, Lincoln, and three of the recent ones that they can remember,
Mm-hmm.
Well, That's what most CEOs do when you ask this question. Who are your five best employees? And they'll go, well, Bob's been here forever and Sarah's been here forever. And then these three, they come in my office all the time, or they're a family relative. And so that's my five. If you ask me that question from my experience of taking over organizations, I used to do this. Very early after I would take over an organization, I would ask the department heads, tell me your five best employees. And I would write them down, and I would keep them in the middle drawer of my desk. Because 6 months later, we would have implemented some performance measures, and I would be producing monthly performance reports. And we would measure things like productivity, number of widgets produced, how many errors were made, how many phone calls were answered, absenteeism, how much was this person not here, customer compliments, how many compliments from customers did this person receive for quality service. We would start getting monthly reports based upon that data. Then I would call the department managers back in 6 months later, and I would say to them, remember 6 months ago I asked you who were your five best employees? And they go, yeah. I said, well, here's what you said. Does that look right? And they would go, yeah. I said, here's the monthly performance report. And invariably, and of course it would differ by the size of the department. I mean, if there was a department that only had 8 or 10 people, then they'd get a higher percentage right. But generally, they would have gotten one or two correct out of the five. And then three or four of the highest performers would come as a total shock to them, because they were picking, pardon my French, they were picking the butt kissers.
Sure.
They were picking the people that they personally went to lunch with. They were picking the people that had been there longer. They were not picking on the basis of anything having to do with actual performance. Guess who was producing? The people who were quietly, unassumingly, first of all, showing up every day instead of being absent 20% of the time, showing up every day and quietly doing the work while the person that the boss picked as the most productive was out with the boss at a 2-hour lunch. That person was out having a 2-hour lunch with the boss while this other person was doing their share of the work.
Out of sight, out of mind.
That is a high performance culture.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
I'm a leader in any kind of an organization. Let's pick on small business a little bit. I've got an affinity for these folks. I'm a small to medium sized business owner, and I'm really interested in doing this. I'm not satisfied. I'm not happy. Life is good, but I'm a rare bird, and then I'm fixated on, yeah, but how good could it be? And I want to start, but I don't have a clue. I mean, give me a few initial things that I could do to just kind of get the journey going. And I've got enough curiosity that I'm willing to learn, I'm willing to read, I'm willing to invest in talking to other people, but I'm not real sure even how to begin, especially when it comes to the things that might be important to manage. What if I'm worried about, you know, what if I'm going to spend a lot of time and energy, and the things that I'm going to measure, they're not really going to matter?
Well, first of all, not only my experience, but also the experience of a lot of other high-performance processes like Lean, like Malcolm Baldrige, like Balanced Scorecard, like Kaizen. There's a bunch of high-performance processes out there. And absolutely every one of them consistently and without fail produces 20 to 40% improvement in performance, measurable performance, reduced errors, increased production per staff, so on and so forth. Measurable improvements of 20 to 40% consistently, if it's actually done. So it's been proven that if you actually do it, you're going to get 20 to 40% better.
Just pick a horse and ride.
That's promised. Yeah. That's promised. That's guaranteed. Now, a core way to get started, if I were to tell somebody to just do one thing to get you going and to get off of square one, I would say pick your two or three most common processes, just like that question I asked a minute ago. Pick your two to three processes that your organization spends the most of its time either performing that process and also the resources that you invest in doing that. The staff that you hire, the staff time that they spend on it, if you have to buy materials that are used to produce that product, everything that goes into your costs for the production of that product, look at those two to three processes. Meet with your staff. Meet with the people that are doing it, the experts, the people that are doing it 8 to 10 hours a day, and talk with them about how can we do this better? How can we do it faster? How can we reduce our errors? How can we possibly reduce our costs without cutting our quality of product? Is there a way to reduce our cost? You know, currently, I'm just making this up. Currently, this product has 9 screws in it. Could we slightly redesign it so we go from needing 9 screws to just 8 screws? Well, if you're making 1,000 of those a day, that's 1,000 screws a day that you're not having to buy anymore. So scrub your three most critical tasks that your organization performs. See what that does for you. And then I would say 80 to 90% of the time you're going to be hooked and you're going to go, okay, now what?
Let's wrap up. And I want you to tell our audience about the book and how the book came to be. And I want to be kind of shameless and promote what I think the book can do for any size organization.
My book is sort of, if you will, the culmination of my career. Like I said, I started about 40 years ago, walking up behind that lady and watching her type in those names 13 times. And me thinking, okay, well, how can we reduce this from 13 times to 1? And I've been doing that for 40 years, and I've been not only studying it and analyzing it and actually living it as a supervisor myself for 40 years, but I've tried to get smarter by being certified in Lean in Baldrige, by studying the great organizations, the Southwest Airlines, the Disneys, the Patagonias, the Drury Inns. I've got a story in one sentence. I was staying at a Drury Inn. Drury Inn has won numerous awards. They're one of the usual suspects as a high-performing culture. I was sitting in a Drury Inn one morning eating breakfast. They had a little buffet breakfast there. And I'm eating the breakfast, and I look up, and there is a woman unassumingly just sweeping the floor. She had a broom, and she had a dustpan, and she's just sweeping the floor in the breakfast room. And the afternoon before, when I was checking into the hotel, she was behind the front desk with a couple of the clerks, and I had been able the afternoon before to read her name tag, and it said she was the manager. So I'd learned the afternoon before that this was the manager, and she's in there sweeping the floor of the dining room during breakfast, and just, you know, looks like a janitor. And now I forgot where I was going. Oh, anyway. 40 years later, I have had time to study, to learn, to also experience from my own personal management life experiences. And I have experimented with a lot of the recommendations, a lot of the things that Lean recommends, a lot of the things that Baldrige recommends, a lot of the things that Southwest and Disney and Drury and the most respected organizations do. I've actually had the opportunity to try those, to experiment with them in my own organizations. And I've learned that some of them get more bang for the buck than others. I've learned that some of them should be done first and then another one done after you've done another one first. One comes before the other. I've learned that some of them require more allocation of resources than other ones do. You asked me a minute ago about a small business that would kind of like to get started, but they don't have a whole lot of resources to invest in it. I've also studied what are the things that you can do that don't take much. They don't require buying a $5,000 computer system, or they don't require paying Lean $10,000 for one of its consultants to come in and tell you what to do. These are things you can literally do yourself, and you can do them without hardly any investment in hiring somebody or in buying a computer package, and you can do them without very much time investment either. And over the years, I've increasingly boiled that down to where what I now have in the book, and on the cover of the book, it mentions the 12 actions that create the biggest bang for the buck. What are the 12 things that the Disneys do, the Southwest Airlines do, the Drury Inns do, the Patagonia clothing stores do? What are the 12 things that they do that are sort of the starter kit? They are the quick and easy, you know, get it up and going. You can implement this quickly and easily. And as I told the story a little while ago, I took over this organization that was in absolute collapse, and I had it running on its own, even without me. I sat in my office and was twiddling my thumbs a year and a half later, and the line staff was running the organization while they were at lunch. So I got it from the front page of the paper to being a high-performing culture within a year and a half. And you can do it even in shorter time than that, depending on the size of your organization. So that's what my book is. My book is 40 years of accumulated learning, applying what I learned, trying it, testing it. Yeah, this works. This doesn't work as well. This is a bigger bang for the buck. Oh, I should have done C before I did A. It's the accumulation of all of that, and I've written it in, I tell parables, I tell stories, like the stories in there about the manager of Drury sweeping the floor, Herb Kelleher asking how come NASCAR can turn a car around in 30 seconds, but it takes us 18 minutes, blah, 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 blah. All of those real world, real life stories are in there. So it's written in a fun style. It's also got worksheets.
Yeah, I was going to say it's very much a workbook ish kind of a book. It is not a tome.
No,
it is, you know, it's very practical, I really love about
it. It's do this. It's do it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Here it is spelled out.
Yeah. He is. Well, I'm gonna call you doctor. I'm gonna embarrass you, Dr. David Childs. So it's really good to be in the presence of this kind of experience and insight. Hope you guys got something from this. And I'm gonna put links in the show notes to his website and ways for you to get the book. The book is called The Organization Whisperer.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I want to thank David and his wife, Alice, for extending hospitality to me and my wife as David and I sat and had this conversation and recorded it in his home. Very gracious. Check David out by going to theorganizationwhisperer.com, theorganizationwhisperer.com. You can go to the show notes of the website over at growgreat.com, episode 39, season 2020. I'll put links there to David's website as well as to his LinkedIn profile and would encourage you to check him out. I'm holding in my hands his four-page CV. I mean, talk about a fellow that just makes me feel like a piker and a gross underachiever. Man alive. But we need smart people like David on the planet to help those of the rest of us that aren't quite so smart. So thanks again to David. Thanks to you for listening. I greatly appreciate it. And I hope that you got great value from it. We're going to lean heavily into this high-performing stuff. So stay tuned and subscribe to the podcast. The website, again, is growgreat.com. Be well, do good, grow great. My name is Randy Cantrell. Greetings and welcome inside the Yellow Studio.